Starlight Lounge presents An Evening with the Progressive Box.
Old moon, yeah. That's Hugo, tickling the ivories. He just saved by bundling home and auto with Progressive. Gonna finally buy a ring for that gal of yours, Hugo? Send her my condolences. Hi-o! This next one's for you, too. There's a burglar in my heart. Thank you.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Discounts not available in all states or situations.
Welcome, everyone, to Creating a Family. Talk about adoption and infertility. Today we're going to be talking about parenting techniques to prevent adoption failure. This is a topic near and dear to my heart, and actually near and dear to Creating a Family's heart. I think you are really going to enjoy this show. Here's a sample of what you're going to hear.
One of the things that I found in my study and have been found in a handful of other studies, including studies even in Sweden, is that the more educated the parents are, and the higher their socioeconomic status, the greater risk there was of difficulties in adoption.
I'm Dawn Davenport. I'm the director of Creating a Family. We are the National Adoption and Infertility Education and Support Nonprofit. You can find us online at creatingafamily.org. We are a weekly radio show, and we use the podcast model. That way you can listen whenever and wherever you want. You can also subscribe to the podcast to get notice of each new episode directly to your phone. You can decide then if you want to listen to it or not. To subscribe, you can go to whatever app it is you are using on your phone to listen to this, or if you are on your computer listening, you can go to the radio show page of our website and subscribe there, and that is creatingafamily.org/radioshow. This show is underwritten by our corporate sponsor, Ferring Pharmaceutical. Fighting cancer does not have to mean a loss of your fertility. If you or a loved one are facing cancer, you may be eligible for no-cost medication through Ferring's Heartbeat Program. To learn more, you can go to their website, heartbeatprogram.com. Or, of course, you can talk to your doctor and get some information that way as well. This show, as well as all the resources provided by Creating a Family, could not happen without the generous support of our gold sponsors who believe in our mission of providing unbiased education and support to those struggling to create a family. Some of our gold sponsors include Adoption Connections. They are a California-based adoption agency working with families throughout the U.S. They were a national pioneer in open adoption and are a respected and are respected for ethical practices, compassion, and openness to adoptive and birth families of all types. We also have Children's Connection. They are an adoption agency with offices throughout Texas providing domestic infant adoption, embryo donation adoption, home studies, and post-adoption support to families throughout the U.S. We have the law offices of James Fletcher Thompson. They are a South Carolina firm committed to adoption and assisted reproductive law. And Nightlight Christian Adoptions. They have been helping children connect with loving families for more than 50 years. They have offices from coast to coast providing international, domestic, foster, and embryo donation and adoption services. In addition, those are some of our gold sponsors, but in addition, we have other sponsors whose generosity allows us to bring you this show. We ask that when choosing an adoption service provider, please consider choosing one from the Creating a Family directories, which you can find on the service provider page of our site. You can search by location, services provided, number of years in operation, just a host of factors that we think are important when choosing. And by using these directories, you support those who support us, so we thank you. Today, we're going to be talking about parenting techniques to prevent adoption failures. Our guest is Dr. Richard Barth. He is the Dean of the School of Social Work at the University of Maryland School of Social Work, as well as the President of the American Academy of Social Work and Social Welfare. And he is also a prodigious adoption researcher with over 50 studies under his belt, as well as author or co-author to 12 books and many chapters and paper. Welcome, Dr. Barth, to Creating a Family.
It's great to be on, Dawn.
Well, this is, as I said, a topic that is near and dear to my heart. I think it's really near and dear to the heart of any of us who care deeply about adoptions, be we adoption professionals, adoption educators, or adoptive parents, or maybe even just humans, because we're talking about children and families, and we should all hope that they succeed. I want to start by just talking about adoption dissolutions in general. However, I think we need to get our nomenclature set first. I wish it weren't this way, because I think, quite frankly, that there is confusion in the terminology. Maybe not so much with the professionals, but certainly in the popular literature, and certainly amongst parents there is confusion. But anyway, I'm going to try to lay out what the correct language is. And in particular, I want to distinguish between adoption disruption and adoption dissolution. Adoption disruption are adoptions who terminate or do not go forward prior to the adoption being finalized. And that more often happens in foster care adoption, where the child has been placed in the family and there is a period of time where the child is living with the family, but prior to the adoption being finalized, usually around the 6 months, but it differs by state. Adoption dissolution is when an adoption has been finalized, the child is legally the child of the adoptive family, and the adoption falls apart at that point. Did I get all that right, Dr. Barr?
Yes, I think that's right. But I think in a broader sense, your use of the term adoption failure may be more helpful. Because I think a lot of what we think of with regard to the outcomes of adoption has to do also with how we experience the relationships that we're in adoption. So although these are fairly rare outcomes, adoption disruption and adoption dissolution, a much more common outcome, unfortunately, but not as common as a successful adoption, I should make that clear, but a more common outcome is what we might call adoption displacement, where a child spends some time out of the adoptive family before rejoining the adoptive family, or even in a more general sense, what you might say is adoption despair, where the family is really struggling. They're despairing the fact that they aren't having the kind of experience they had dreamed of and hoped for. And those are the more common things that people face in adoption, rather than dissolution, disruption, which are very important and have significant implications, but are, as you say, more or less restricted to the foster care adoption population.
And I'm glad you make that. You and I need to go on a campaign to try to change the terminology, because I really do find I like adoption failure. But that is not the term necessarily being used. But okay, we'll come back to that. But I'm glad that you broadened it, because I'd like to. Right now, we are going to talk about adoption dissolution. But then, for the rest after that, in the show, I'd like to broaden the term to adoption failure to include adoptions that just aren't thriving, which would include adoption displacement and adoption despair, which I agree with you are more common. But let me start now with adoption dissolutions, if for no other reason than they are certainly in the popular media, and or at least the popular media that I'm following, as well as Creating a Family runs a very large mm-hmm. online support group, and it's a topic that's talked about there, and I think more misinformation than information exists out there. So how common are adoption dissolutions? And again, that is adoptions that have finalized but then fall apart after that.
So the research on this has to be thought of in kind of broad terms. A lot of the studies that have been done, and I've been involved with adoption disruption and dissolution studies since the 80s and tracked them all pretty well, a lot of the studies that have been done have not made a fine-grained distinction between dissolution and disruption, and lump those things together. Dissolution, and the other thing about these studies is, one, we don't have a national study. Two, so they tend to be localized, and every state, as many of you know, and even every county and every court does things a little differently. And also, they don't follow groups of children who've been adopted for very long. So the studies that I was involved with when the federal government first became concerned about this, they range from 3 to 5 years in following up children. So that's not a very long time. So understand that the rates I'm going to give you tend to be based on that. So in general, of the special needs foster care adoption, so that's another restriction. Most of these studies have been funded by the Children's Bureau, and their special interest is in foster children adopted from foster care, with usually with some special needs, which doesn't mean a lot. It usually just means they were older than two or had the possibility of some adversity when they were a child. But
or that's even a sibling group. Are considered
or sibling groups, yes, yeah. That's right. Yeah, there are a number of different characteristics. So dissolutions are less than 5% in most of those studies. So disruptions are higher. And as I say, in some of the studies, they're put together, so it's disruptions and dissolutions. And in all cases, they depend in many ways on the age of the child at the time that they are placed.
So, well, wait a second, because I want to come to that. I want to get to that.
Mm-hmm,
because I think that's a really important distinction. And I'm just going to say that, of course, we should expect this. One of the things that I also have not delved into the research anywhere near what you've done, because you're actually the researcher, but have read as much of the research as I can find. And it's so frustrating that they don't distinguish between dissolutions. Again, for the audience, dissolutions are after the adoption is finalized, and disruptions, because one of the advantages, if you want to say it that way, of foster care adoption versus international adoption is that you have a trial period where the child is living in your home so that it's better, the parents are in a better position to be able to determine if they are the right family to parent this child. So we would expect, I mean, that's not the purpose, of course, of that trial period,
mm-hmm.
but we would expect that's not necessarily a failure in that sense, that period of time is for the family to and the child and the social worker, everybody working together in theory, to determine if it is a good fit. So, of course, we would think that disruptions are higher, as well they should be. And that's at least how I see it. Is that, am I looking at it correctly?
That's right. Absolutely. I think it is a trial period. It's one where everybody's very hopeful. The family, the social worker, and most importantly, the child are all very hopeful. So it's significant and difficult when it ends, but that is the purpose of it, to see that there is a reasonable fit. So the dissolution is a much more significant issue, and fortunately, it also seems to be more rare.
And so the studies that you've seen that distinguish between the dissolution and disruption and single out dissolution, what you're seeing is less than about 5%, and this is primarily in the foster care community. Am I understanding you correctly?
So that's correct, but I think it's also really important to say that one of the things we've been seeing more of lately is older child dissolutions. And so it's important to recognize that the studies that we did only followed kids for about 3 to 5 years, as I said. And most children who are adopted are fairly young. We certainly do adopt some children who are older. But if I think, so this is pure speculation. If we followed kids for 21 years, then the dissolution rate would certainly be higher. Of course, it couldn't be lower. How high it would be, I don't know. But there's no question that there are families who end up having a dissolution when their children become teenagers because they're trying to get treatment services that they can't arrange, especially including residential care, and we'll come back to that later in terms of whether that's a good choice. And the only way they can get that residential care in some jurisdictions is to relinquish the child back to the foster care agency so the foster care agency can pay for those placements because the adoptive family runs out of resources. So there is So 5% would be the lower bound, and how often that latter scenario happens is not known, but it's significant enough that there are a number of states that are now trying to find ways to deal with those older child relinquishments back to the agency, which are basically dissolutions.
And something that they also, the studies that you were involved with, as I understand them, they don't track international adoptions. And how common, so that's a question that, has there been research? The State Department supposedly tracks it, but I'm not sure that they're capturing everything. I don't know. So we certainly hear a lot about international adoptions, and one thing that might make them more at risk of dissolution is that for the vast majority of international adoptions, the adoption is finalized in the country. So the adoption is over with before the parents have ever had the child in their home, and sometimes, you know, almost immediately upon meeting the child. So what do we know about the risks or the numbers about adoption dissolutions? And almost all of them would be dissolutions, not disruptions, since
right.
would be, the only way they could disrupt is if the family decides and meets the child, sees and decides in country that the child's needs are greater than they can handle and doesn't go through with it. But so once they come back to the U.S., it's a dissolution. So what do we know about those?
Not very much. We really don't know what that rate is. We do know that the likelihood probably is highest in the first 18 months, but which is true of other adoption disruptions and dissolutions, that many of them seem to occur at that in the first 18 months. Although, as I said, that is partly because we haven't followed them long enough to know whether there are other periods of high likelihood, other age periods when there's a high likelihood of disruption. So right now we know very little about dissolutions of international placements, except really just these stories that we hear mostly in the media.
Well, I will say that I hear stories from adoption professionals. We provide a lot of adoption resources and education and continuing education and things like that for adoption professionals. And I certainly hear it. I just don't know the numbers. I think it, of course, any time an agency has a family that this happens to, it's up front and center on their mind. So it could be that they're talking about it because they're concerned about it, not because it's necessarily frequent, but that because it's such a tragedy when it happens.
Absolutely. And one of the things that I learned in my first disruption study was that I would talk to workers and they would say, well, I placed this sibling group of two together and there was a disruption and I'm never going to do that again. It was the most painful experience of my life. So many of them only had one disruption or dissolution in their career and they remembered it vividly and painfully and made decisions about that, about the future based on that. And yet when we did our research, we learned that if you place two children together into a family without any other children in it, they actually have a very high rate of success. So this is a very vivid experience, and it is hard sometimes to separate out that the impact of that vividness and the characteristics of things that go wrong from the more general literature.
Good point, and I definitely want to come back to that. In fact, we'll go ahead and talk about that now. What I'd like to talk about is what, if we can draw some general characteristics about adoptions that are more at risk for falling apart, for failure. And this one, we might say failure because it would include adoption dissolution, certainly, but also adoption displacement. And I love the term in adoption despair. So let's start with age. What do we know? How much is age a risk factor for adoption failure? Let me back up there because there's a distinction to be made there.
That's a good distinction. It does seem to be quite a significant risk factor. So what we don't know much about is the variation, even for very young children, how much difference it makes if you adopt a child at birth versus 1 year or 18 months or 2 years. We don't know much about that. The studies have mostly looked at children adopted at 3 years or older. And then you see pretty much a straight line relationship between the ages of children and the likelihood of some either a disruption or a dissolution. So that at about 3 years old, it's less than 10%, maybe 6-7% of those of children who are adopted at 3 years old have such an outcome. By the time you get to 12, it's in the low 20%. And we don't know much about teenage adoptions, and now adoptions are happening even for children who are 16, 17, 20, 21. We don't really know much about those. But we do know that at least from 3 to about 12, it's the rate does go up with every year of age.
One of the questions that we have received is wondering about the infant adoption dissolutions. Is that extremely rare, and are there risk factors for that, or is it so rare really that it's hard to draw risk factors associated with it?
So we don't really have much research about that, but I will just tell an anecdote. One of the other studies that we did, Devon Brooks and I from University of Southern California, so we looked at children who were adopted in the 70s, and some of you may have known the book Chosen Children that Bill Feigelman and Arnie Silverman wrote. And we followed up on those people who were adopted in the 70s, and many of these were transracial adoptions, but it was a whole mix when they were in their 30s. And we kept trying to look to see how much age of adoption really made a difference in terms of their outcomes. And I remember saying, well, let's cut it off at 3. You know, we'll look at the kids adopted older than 3 or younger than 3. And to make a long story short, we kept moving the age down to 2, to 1, to 6 months, and we didn't really find huge differences there. And I think it's and these were in terms of general outcomes. This wasn't about disruption or dissolution. This was about their general well-being as 20-somethings and early 30-somethings. Mm-hmm. And the conclusion that I came to is that children who are born to parents who have are trying to figure out what to do about the mothers who are trying to figure out what to do about the fact that they're pregnant, trying to figure out is their partner a reliable partner, do they want to carry this child to term, do they want to have this child live with their families, do they want to place this child with adoption. So all the things that a mother of a newborn would go through have already experienced a stressful environment. They've already created some environmental challenges for those children. And it's not that there can't be great outcomes, you know, Steve Jobs, Gerald Ford, and so on, you know all those stories. But on the other hand, there are adversities in the environment, whether it's the prenatal environment or the postnatal environment, that do begin very early. And in general, kids who are adopted have more variability in their experience. That's the way I like to talk about it. And maybe that sounds social science-y and jargony, but there's more variation in what their outcomes are going to be than kids who are not adopted. That doesn't mean that on average there can't be great outcomes and exceptional outcomes and wonderful family experiences, but the one thing you can expect is that there's going to be more variability for your adopted kids than your sister's birth children on average. I'm talking, you know, in general terms. And so the risks for adopted kids are a little higher in general because of this variability, that there will be something like adoption despair at some point in this relationship.
Okay, that's I'm going to be. Let me just. This will be a tease for an upcoming show. We have a show coming up in June, I believe, with Dr. David Brodzinski, talking specifically about mental health issues in adoption, adopted kids. So, for our audience, this will be something that we will come back to. So, actually, and to find out about our upcoming shows, we primarily keep in touch with people through our weekly adoption newsletter. So sign up for it on any page of our site, and it's once a week, and we will send you recent developments in the world of adoption, as well as resources that we've added to our site that week, and telling you what the upcoming show topics are so that you can submit questions for the expert. All right, so we don't really know what it is. I mean, we don't know the risk for infants, but as I understand what you're saying, we do know that there has been, even when there has not been prenatal exposure, there has been an environment that could be stressful. So children, there will be greater variability for how these children will do, although, to be honest, we know that the vast majority will do well, but because, of course, we all face issues in our lives, and this is one of them. But nonetheless, we do know that that from what you're saying, that there is greater variability. All right. So now I'd like to move our discussion. Before we back up, another question. Before I go to that, let me ask one last question, to kind of in general talking. One of the things that has been said about when we're trying to actually analyze the data, and there isn't a lot of good data, I think that's become clear, and because even the studies that exist, many of them are flawed for really trying to determine, to answer the question of how often adoptions fall apart after the adoption. But when we do that, when we do try to cite, one thing that people come back with is that, well, those are not, they're not tracking, and none of the research is tracking what has come to be known in the popular press as rehoming. Children who are being sent to live with another family, and it's not or at least it doesn't start off as a legal adoption. Is that true? Do we have any information on numbers of children who, if it's dissolved and it goes back, the child goes back to the state welfare system, the state foster care system, then we have a way of tracking that, although we really don't. Is there any information that says how often they fall apart and the child is sent to live with another family and nobody is tracking it?
So no, we don't have any way of tracking rehoming, simply put. There are certainly, we don't have any way of tracking even adoption displacements. We could. Many of the kids in foster care who have been adopted, their families receive an adoption subsidy to support some basic needs that those children might have, and they should be, those subsidies should end if the child moves someplace else. Other than a approved residential treatment program or something like that. But all of that data is kept at the state level. There's no national look at that. And some of us have done, studies about that in different states, but we really don't have a national picture.
Yeah, exactly. And if they're not being checked up on, they may be accepting the subsidy and still not have the child, and we wouldn't be tracking that either.
And the federal government has moved to improve that. So now adoptive families do have to send in a record of that the child is enrolled in school and so on to make sure that the child is with the adoptive families. So there's been some improvements there, but it's still all pretty loose. And certainly a child could be living with a neighbor or with a family, an extended family member, and going to a school, and so it's pretty loose.
Yeah, and it's only fair to say at this point that this displacement that you talk about happens in biological families too.
Oh yeah,
where
and,
you know, teen gets a little more than, or a child or a teen gets to be more than the parents feel like they can handle, or they feel like they're not handling it well and they need somebody to step in. And the child is sent to live with an aunt or an uncle or a grandparent or whatever.
Absolutely.
You know, situations that that have happened there.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, when we posted on our social networks to solicit questions, we got quite a few questions from families, which was good because they were thinking, families talking about how can we tell before an adopt, before there has been a placement, if this child is a good fit for our family, which is a good thing because we want families to think in terms of what are they capable or what it, what type of child are they the best parent for. So that's a good, it's a good place for us to start. Let me read one that we received from, well, I'll read a couple of them. Kelly writes, what are some specific questions to ask the social worker, therapist, etc., to determine if a child is a good fit for your family? Like she wants to say, going beyond, is he good with other children? Or into asking more specific questions, would he be able to share a room? Can he be alone with other children? Things like that. So what are some warning signs that you may not be prepared to parent this particular child? So she wants to know specific questions to ask and then warning signs. So let's start with just hers, and I'll read some of the others.
Okay. So there are two parts to that. One of them is questions to ask a social worker about a child, and the other is questions to ask yourself.
Exactly.
So I want to talk about both of those. So it is important to know when this child has difficulty, when does this child have the most difficulty? Is it during transitions? Is it being alone? Is it in competition? Is it at school? Is it in unstructured settings and so on? The other is how, what is the most extreme that the behavior gets? Because some people will say, well, yeah, well, I just won't leave them, you know, in a situation like this or that. But then when things get quite extreme, they get scared and they think that this is just going to always be like that and that this is not a exception or sort of the highest rate of problems, but is predictable that it's going to continue to occur. And the third part of that is, what are some of the strategies that this foster parent or the foster parent or the worker or even if they're in residential care have used to get a, help a child get back to equilibrium? So those are all, I think, part of sort of the questioning, because it's the extreme high rate behavior that really gets to parents. To a certain extent, it's also over a longer period of time, parents can wear down from just the exhaustion of working to correct a whole range of different things that come up. But knowing something about what's the worst time this child has ever had is really important. The questions about yourself are also really important. One of the things that I found in my study and have been found in a handful of other studies, including studies even in Sweden, is that the more educated the parents are and the higher their socioeconomic status, the greater risk there was of difficulties in adoption. In different studies, it's studied in different ways. In Sweden, it was studied looking at psychiatric placements of kids. In the U.S., we look at disruption and dissolution and so on. And that's sort of an uncommon finding, isn't it, right?
Yeah.
Most of the time,
yeah.
We are not a high-risk group, those of us, and I speak we because my wife and I have PhDs and we have adopted kids, and so we found ourselves in this high-risk group. Turns out that what we might define in the old language of blue-collar families or families that are not so highly educated are more robust as adoptive settings for kids. That works out a little better. So one of the things you have to ask yourself is, am I so busy, and even though I think I can take time out to deal with this, am I so busy that I really can't put things down to really engage a child in a meaningful way, and I'm going to rely instead on all kinds of programs and treatments like I do with my daily life, where I take my dry cleaning here and I drop my car off to do that, and I use Amazon to buy my, you know, everything that I need. And am I really going to be able to step back when this child has one of those experiences and figure out what's going on and really be in a deep relationship with them that takes, that may take lots of time and lots of introspection? And am I really willing to do that? And am I willing to do things that this child would really like to do, rather than trying to get them to fit into what I like to do so that I can kind of keep my own usual lifestyle intact?
That is such a good point. All of those are such good points. I think in particular, as I'm reflecting on what you said, that, and is this a good summary of the, of one, you made a number of points there, but people in higher socioeconomics are used to hiring out services and not doing them themselves. And if I'm understanding you correctly, the business of parenting, particularly parenting children who've experienced abuse and neglect, is intensely personal and intensely time-consuming. So that's fascinating.
You said it much more clearly than I did, but that's right.
Well, that's really very, very interesting. And so the one of the questions that we can ask ourselves is, fess up from the, I mean, truly look at yourself and say, these children are going to take more time, and am I willing to alter my life to do that? Absolutely fascinating. I'm going to be thinking on that one for a while. Are there, we get a question from Allison, and she says, are there any, this is so general. Actually, I'm not going to read hers. I'm going to come to hers, because I will subsume her question into a later discussion. Let's see, and we've got a question, this is from Rosalie, how can parents truly self-assess their own strengths as well as their needs of their family going into adoption? Assessing your strengths and knowing what type of child that you are best capable, if and will you be capable of meeting the needs of this child? That may have been somewhat answered by what you just said.
Well, I'd like to say a little bit more about it.
Sure.
So I think it's a great question, and I applaud whoever asked it, because it really reflects on what needs to be done, is trying to figure that out as much as you can in advance. So those strengths have to do with your own ability to have long and loyal relationships. These relationships last a long time, and they can hit a lot of bumps. And so part of it is looking to see how you do in relationships that are complicated and that last a long time. Some of it has to do with looking at your own family and the supports in your family. One of the things we found in the original disruption study, and admittedly that was a long time ago, I think that book was published in the early 90s, so take that into account, but was that families that adopted children into their home who already had a biological child had a slightly higher than expected rate of disruption. And part of that was because, well, it's one thing to have a child who throws tantrums and makes life complicated and takes up some of the time that we just talked about, but it's a whole nother thing when they break the arm of a sibling, or they are setting a really bad example for a child who's in the home, or they do something else that threatens the well-being of a child who's already in your home and who you already have a deep relationship to. So that's another thing that needs to be assessed. To some extent, it's helpful to assess family. Most people these days have family who are very excited about adoption, so it's not as big a deal as it used to be, but knowing whether your family is really going to be there in thick or thin, or whether this is going to create conflict with grandparents or siblings or others who matter to you, and if at some point you have to make a choice between disapproving family members who think that you're not parenting right because this child isn't doing well, and that you should be more, you should be harsher, or you should be more restrictive, and you're, that isn't the way you want to approach this, then that's also something to know, because it's hard to anticipate that, but sometimes you can tell whether your family's really ready to support all of you or whether this is going to divide you. And then the last thing is, as much as you can understand the way you approach things and whether it's consistent or not with your partner, if you have a partner, is really important. That's another cause of disruptions. And then sometimes divorces that follow when one family member just sort of says, this was your idea, you got to finish this up, I can't deal with this anymore, and kind of distances themselves from the whole situation of the adoption. And that is certainly, that threatens the whole family's dynamic. So hard to anticipate any of these things. We often don't know. I can tell you from personal experience, I have a son who's 33 now and homeless in Las Vegas, and adopted son, and my wife and I spent time this morning trying to figure out who was going to do what or wasn't going to do what to try to help him at this point in his life. And so it's a ongoing saga, and you have to have some confidence that you can communicate about these difficult challenges.
And one thing as to your relationship with your partner, is part of that also assessing if one of you, I think it is very common, let me back up and say, I think it is very common for there be in families, in between couples, for there to be one who is the mover and shaker and the pusher for adoption.
True.
And the other one to be the follower. I think it is so common that, in fact, that can't be a risk factor per se, because
True.
Then we would all be at risk. However, I think that you speak to something different, which is there's one thing to be following but not doing your own research and being on board and being, you know, willing to think through the issues. And there's a whole other thing about somebody who really is against the idea. Is that also part of that, not only the way that you approach things with your spouse or your partner, but also how committed your partner is to the whole thing? Is that also a factor?
Yeah, I think that is. I mean, obviously, if they're not very committed, that is a risk factor. But I was also trying to get at something a little more, which is that if there's a dynamic in a relationship where when things get difficult, one person withdraws and sort of hands off the responsibilities for it, maybe you've dealt with things like that and can anticipate that, and it's still fine to go forward with it. But that is not an uncommon dynamic in what happens, is that the two partners have unequal interest in really resolving the challenges rather than dissolving the adoption. And if that's a pattern in your relationship that you've struggled with before, it can certainly be a significant issue in adoption.
Yeah, that makes very good sense. You are listening to Creating a Family, and today we're talking about parenting techniques, or techniques for parenting, to prevent adoption dissolutions or adoption failures is actually a better term. Creating a Family has the largest adoption and infertility communities on the social networks, and we would love to have you join us. Clout now ranks us as the number 2 online influencer worldwide in the areas of adoption as well as actually infertility. There are 3 ways to connect with us on Facebook. One is, of course, we have a page, and you can like that page, and you can find it at facebook.com/creatingafamily. We also have a very large and very active online support group. It is a closed group, so you have to request to join, and you can find that at facebook.com/groups/creatingafamily, or you can just type in the words Creating a Family in the Facebook search box, and you can like the page and join the group. You can also connect with me personally. I am dawn.davenport1, and we hang out on Pinterest and Twitter as well, and we go by @creatingafamily on both of those. All right, now I want to move to talking about some specific techniques. We got a hard question from Sherry. She says, and I'm going to read the whole thing. It's a little long. she says, can you talk about the type of safety measures, then which ones are within the law and which ones could get your children removed, such as locking them in their room, keeping locks on the house to prevent them from getting out. I would also like to hear discussions on things like child harness leases or the beds that some people make that has a cage over them. In that case, the children were removed. My son had told me to build a jail cell in the house so we could still see him, but the other children would be safe. I didn't, but now I wonder if maybe things would have turned out better. Now, three children were raped, and he has a life behind a much lonelier set of bars. So I guess what I'm asking in general is about the type of restraints that are okay and what type of restraints are viewed as a reason to remove the child.
What a poignant question.
It is a poignant question.
So I think a lot of that depends on the local conditions and the relationship you have with the Department of Social Services, whether you've brought them along with understanding about what's going on. Assuming this is a social services related, child welfare related adoption. If you brought them along, then I think you get a lot more leeway in terms of what your strategies are. In general, I don't think there's ever a question about having an alarm system that allows you to know whether anybody is coming or going from your house. Lots of treatment foster care homes have systems like that, and those are well understood. I think if you have a child who you have enclosed in a space outside the house, that's in a garage or a shed or something like that, that would be considered very negative, too aversive. I think if you have a child who is in your home and you feel like they are a threat to your other children, as was the case here, then what would ordinarily be recommended would be a residential treatment placement for them in order to get some of their behavior under control, especially if they have a penchant towards being a sexual offender. So there are special group homes in some cases where only one child is in that home, or treatment foster care where one child is in that home and there are interventions that are delivered there. In some cases, you could even try to get support for in-home intensive monitoring. So someone who stays awake with a child like that and monitors them. But that's very hard to arrange. You'd have to have a very flexible, supportive mental health service system helping you with that. But in general, I think anything that appears like a cage is going to be problematic. The main thing is that you could certainly have alarms on other children's rooms, so that if this child goes into other children's rooms, that becomes known. But anything that involves shackling or caging is going to be unacceptable for the most part.
Well, let's talk about some techniques that do work for parents who are struggling with children that perhaps not to the extreme, or maybe even to the extreme that Sherry mentions, that are not easy to parent, and you as a parent are beginning to see yourself struggling. We have certainly seen here at Creating a Family that the first 6 months to 1 year are often the critical time period. So I'm curious to see, number one, if you have seen that, and if not, or if so, then what are some techniques that parents can use during this period of time to smooth that transition and set themselves up for success?
So I think there are many different critical times. That is certainly one of them. The transition to young adult, to the pre-adolescent period is also very critical. The transition to adolescence itself, very challenging. Even the transition to young adulthood, very challenging. So taking a lot of time off if you can, for the transition of a child into your home. So many people only get a short time off from family leave, assuming they even have family leave, to spend time with a child. But the more that you can spend where you're there every day, if you can get a child enrolled in school quickly, that's usually a plus, but not always. That's really important. Creating a network of resources right away, staying involved with families. I think parent support groups are absolutely critical. Adoptive parents know a lot of things that they've tried and done that have worked that are really important. Focusing on the things that your child does well, trying to keep your positive comments versus your suggestions for what needs to be different to some kind of ratio, like 4 positive things that they're doing for every suggestion you make, or even higher than that, so that you're not suggesting changes and corrections all the time, but you're spending a lot of time observing the even very small positive things that are going on and communicating those. That's important. Trying to find some activities that are fun and recreational and that help strengthen your relationship, so that as other more serious corrections are needed, there's a relationship there and some meaning to the fact that you may withdraw some of your attention or you may be disappointed, that you have to build up the relationship capital in order to make that a meaningful intervention. Those are some of the things I think of.
Those are all excellent, and I particularly appreciate the last one, because I think that the one about, and I'm going to quote you on that, build up your relationship capital, that is something that we say so often here, is that it is so helpful. I mean, this is all relationship. Parenting, especially as your children age, but even when they're very young, is really relationship-based, and you need to be doing something that you enjoy with that child, so that you, it's not always hard, that there's something that you and that child look forward to. And sometimes that takes a little bit of work on the parent's part, because the kid's not going to be able to give on that one. You've got to be the one who gives and tries to find something that the child enjoys doing that you would also enjoy doing. It's important that you both get something out of it and even look forward to it. So be it going to the movies.
I think that's really important.
I know. It's so very important.
A special point I wanted to make about that is that going to the movies is one of them, but I think it's really also important that parents take on activities that they don't know how to do very well, so that a child can see them learn, see them take risks, see them fall down and not be able to do things and gradually figure that out, because it's very scary for kids. They don't know what's expected of them. They worry that they're supposed to know how to do all these things. And if parents can demonstrate that in the things they're doing, they're also taking chances and putting themselves into vulnerable situations, I think it helps with the relationship.
Yeah. I wanted to ask some questions or a question about parent support groups. I couldn't agree with you more. And the reality is, especially outside of major metropolitan areas, but even inside many major metropolitan areas, the in-person support groups have really not flourished, and it takes so much work. We run a huge online support group, and I have become such a believer in peer-to-peer online support groups. And I was curious of your opinion on that, as far as finding a support group if you can't find one, or in addition, if you're fortunate enough to have one in your location, to do both. What has been your experience with online support groups?
So I'm not a scientist in that area, but I know enough to know that in a whole range of settings, whether it's working on diabetes or in cancer treatment or in behavioral health, that these are a great resource, and there actually is good science that suggests that they're helpful. And I can only imagine that they would also be very helpful for adoptive families. I'm delighted that you're offering that service.
Yeah, I've become a pain in the neck at times, I will be honest, and they certainly are very much of a time suck from an organizational standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
I absolutely believe I've just seen so many important things. In the time we have left, I want to talk about post-adoption services and support. What do we know? What I have found, and we've done a number of surveys here at Creating a Family with our online, we have, like I say, a very large online community, both in the support group as well as in other places that are not a part of the support group. And the reality is post-adoption support and services in general, both support and education, are sorely lacking. What do we know about what type of post-adoption services and support and education work to help families stay together?
So we really don't know very much about that. I would say that we did have a little evidence from our early study that people who were in post-adoption support groups, and those were face-to-face, did have a somewhat lower likelihood of disruption than similar families who weren't involved. We have never, as a country, really invested in specific post-adoption preservation groups, and there are some agencies that seem to have a very good track record in this. I guess I would say a couple things, though, that we do know a fair amount about what helps families in general. And one of the things that I think is somewhat problematic for us in the adoption field is that we tend to think that adoption itself is the driving force behind all the problems that families experience. And so we tend to think you have to have specialized adoption services that are focused on attachment and are different than other helping services, which are mostly focused not on attachment but on social relationships and social learning theory and cognitive behavioral interventions. And that my money would be on evidence-based interventions that have a social learning base to them and build off of some version of trauma-adapted cognitive behavior therapy as the more effective interventions, even if they aren't about adoption. So not everyone agrees with me about that, but so I think something like multi-systemic therapy or functional family therapy or trauma-focused cognitive behavior therapy are evidence-based interventions that have a great track record and are most likely to be helpful. And hopefully you find somebody there who's adoption-informed or adoption-sensitive to help you. The program I think that adoptive families turn to a lot, which has the least evidence really, is residential treatment. And I've used it myself. It's widely used by adoptive families. You go to any residential treatment program, and there will be more adoptive families there than you would expect in the general population or adopted kids there. And I guess what I would say about that is that the best ones are ones that really involve the family, the adoptive family, a lot. If you think you can send your kid away to a residential treatment program and make that work and have them come back to the environment that they were in before without your being deeply involved with that, that's probably not going to happen. So the family, so residential treatment can work, but it's fairly rare that it has positive outcomes. And I think the best bet for having positive outcomes is if you have a model and a program that's nearby, not halfway across the country, and where you work closely with the treatment providers there to change the way your family operates and the space in your family and the style of family life that this child is has to come back to. Don't expect the resident treatment program to change a child and send them back fixed.
And I think that so often what parents are desperate for when they send their child away is simply a break. I mean, they're also
That's
hoping,
true.
Of course, that their child is going to be miraculously fixed. But really,
That's true.
Even if not, they just desperately need a break. So respite care is there been any, the problem with respite care is it's similar in that it's taking a child away, the family is getting a break, but does that, what's been the, number one, respite care is not always available. In fact, very often it's not, particularly once an adoption has been finalized. But what about a respite care as far as helping a family and helping children?
So I think having a child be able to go to respite care or having a respite care provider come into your home is great. I know some people think, well, it just creates more attachment issues, but I don't really think that's so critical in that particular case. I think sometimes any break that also provides you with some alternatives about how this child looks to other people, how other people have found ways of interacting and being successful with the child. So if a child who's really struggling can spend time with other family members in respite care, the break is important. And also sometimes you get ideas from people who interact with your child about what they really like about your child that you had long ago forgotten.
Yeah, very long ago forgotten. What about one of the things that we think of here at Creating a Family, and this is a post-adoption support and education,
mm-hmm.
real push for us this year in particular, well, always it has been, but in particular we're really focusing on it this year. Any suggestions for, now we are not a local-based group, we're a national group, and that limits, it gives us opportunities that don't exist on the local level, but it also limits what we can do as well. It's both a plus and a negative. Can you make suggestions that of things that run a national level that can be done by groups to provide additional support in addition to things that are being offered locally?
In addition to your national online support
In addition
tools.
To just the support group, one of the things that we struggle with, let me give you an example, is that we have a lot of really wonderful resources and utilizing different media, audio, visual, and different lengths of time and willingness of people to spend time commitments, you know, short tip sheets versus long articles and things like that. So we provide all this stuff. But how do we get it into the hands of families that are struggling before they've given up? Because once they've given up, honestly, we don't have a great success rate of getting them turned around. But if we could get them the support and the education ahead of time when they're still trying, any suggestions on how to do that?
I don't have any great suggestions. I will say that there's a glimmer of hope in the sky, which is that the Children's Bureau has recently put out a funding opportunity announcement to create a national strategy for preparing foster and adoptive parents for foster care and adoption. And so we might finally have that be standardized and hopefully effective. And in that case, hopefully that those families could get connected to these kinds of resources very early on.
Yeah. And that was the last question I wanted to ask, and that is the timing of getting support. You mentioned that earlier when you were talking, and we didn't focus on it, so I wanted to come back to that. I think if I understood you correctly, what you said was it's important to have support lined up even before the child comes mm-hmm. and start taking advantage, even before you think you actually need it, of services, of education, of anything you can, so that you're surrounded by support when, as you move into transition times that could be problematic or even the transitioning time into your home. So let's talk very briefly about the timing of setting up support pre-adoption or post-adoption, I guess.
So I think that's absolutely critical, and that's why adoption support groups are so useful, because you go through phases when you're the resource to them, and then you go through phases when they're the resource to you. And so as many families who give birth to children and have the support of Lamaze groups, some of them stay in touch with those Lamaze groups for decades and continue to work together to try to figure out how do we make the transition to this next age and stage. So I absolutely think that's critical. Also, if you can join in other supportive institutions, as Robert Putnam says, too many of us are bowling alone. And if you have a religious group or a fraternal group or a soft football playing group or a community group that can get to know you and your family and become a resource when things start to get difficult, that is a really critical investment. It doesn't all have to be adoption oriented, because adopted kids are more like other kids than they're different, and adoptive families are more like other families than they're different. And so I think that's another really important piece.
Well, I can't think of a better note to end on, because I couldn't agree with you more. Thank you so much for being with us today, Dr. Richard Barth. Let me break here and remind you that this show, as well as all the resources provided by Creating a Family, could not happen without the generous support of our gold sponsors. So a few more of our gold sponsors that have brought you this show are Holt International. They were founded in 1956 with the mission of finding every child a loving and secure home, and they have led the global community in finding families for children who need them, as well as providing pre- and post-adoption support. We have Vista Del Mar. They are a licensed and accredited nonprofit adoption agency with over 65 years of experience helping to create families. They have three adoption programs: private infant, international, and adoption through foster care. And we have Hopscotch Adoptions. They are a Hague-accredited adoption agency placing children from around the world, offering home study and post-adoption services to residents of North Carolina and New York. We have enjoyed having you with us today. I know that you are going to be interested in getting some more information about Dr. Richard Barth, who is our expert today on this show. You can get more information on him by going to, he is at the University of Maryland School of Social Work, so you can go to their website, which is SSW, standing for School of Social Work. So ssw.umaryland.edu. I also want to direct you that we have many resources here at Creating a Family on this exact topic. The best way to find them is to go to our A to Z Adoption Resource page, which you can find by going to our website, click on the Adoption tab, and then go to the A to Z Resource page. And probably most relevant would be to scroll down to the post-adoption, adoptive parenting, parenting children with special challenges, things such as that. We've got tons and tons of resources that I think would be very helpful. Thank you so much for joining us today, and I will see you next week.
When she became the mother of your children, she showed you a love deeper than you ever imagined. So this Mother's Day, come to Jared, the Galleria of Jewelry, for exclusive Pandora charms that tell her exactly how amazing she is. Like the piece that says it all, the best mother charm, or the dazzling, intricate heart lock dangle. These are pieces that tell her story, and you'll only find them at Jared. The one gift that means everything. That's why he went to Jared.
Let's say you just bought a house. Bad news is, you're one step closer to becoming your parents. You'll proudly mow the lawn, ask if anybody noticed you mowed the lawn, tell people to stay off the lawn, compare it to your neighbor's lawn, and complain about having to mow the lawn again. Good news is, it's easy to bundle home and auto through Progressive and save on your car insurance, which, of course, will go right into the lawn. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company, affiliates, and other insurers. Discount not available in all states or situations.
The Starlight Lounge presents An Evening with the Progressive Box.
Old moon, yeah. That's Hugo tickling the ivories. He just saved by bundling home and auto with Progressive. Gonna finally buy a ring for that gal of yours, Hugo? Send her my condolences. Hi-oh! This next one's for you, too. There's a burglar in my heart. Thank you.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Discounts not available in all states or situations.